So there might be a professor of philosophy present tonight, and I therefore chose this topic. He's not going to be here, so since I advertised it, I'll go through with it. It's ideas that I have inserted at various places in different shiurim, but they were never focused on. They were asides, and I described them only in a limited way. And tonight I want to focus on it more broadly and more intensely, and with a certain structure to the presentation. I want to go slowly enough so that it be adequate discussion. Usually, when I inserted these ideas in other shiurim, I felt under pressure because I was trying to complete another subject, and therefore I couldn't give time for full discussion. So tonight, we'll get as far as we get, but as we go along, if there are questions, something not well understood, I'm happy to discuss it until we feel confident that we do understand it.
So it's not all upset yet?
As I say, not whole, not organized. We weren't organized tonight. No, just I want to describe a couple of problems that we're going to have to grapple with. This is why we have to investigate the subject, and then a couple of assumptions that we're going to make as part of the discussion, and then we'll get into the body of discussion. One fundamental problem is that all of our sources agree that God per se cannot be described. The philosophic sources and the Kabbalistic sources both agree that God cannot be described. Okay, that by itself might not be a terrible problem. There are limits to how much we can know, limits to how much we can understand, limits to how much our minds can grapple with. Everybody's aware that there are limits. Say, well, there's something which you can't understand. Fine. But the trouble is that the tradition is full of descriptions of God. Hundreds of descriptions of God. Throughout the Tanakh, throughout the Talmud, the Midrash, the Siddur, God is being described all the time. So to have this gigantic literature describing God, and then to be told, by the way, you can't describe God, leaves a person in a limbo. They don't know what to do. I can't do it, but I'm doing it all the time. That's one difficulty. Second difficulty is how God relates to the world. It's common, typical to hear descriptions of how God relates to the world, which seem to be right. They especially seem to be very pious. But when you think about them, seriously, they seem to be ridiculous. And one, again, doesn't know exactly what to do. God is everywhere. God fills everything. There isn't anything other than God. That's what we hear. But then, am I really supposed to think that part of God is made of wood? This table is God. God is in the table. The table is part of God. So then part of God is made of wood. If I burn up the table, it means I made part of God into ash. That doesn't sound exactly right. I can imagine someone who will say, okay, so that's just very funny, but we have to accept it. But there's a resistance there to accept something like that. Even worse, the soul is described as a piece of God on high. That's a literal description that's found in our sources. Am I supposed to think I can slice God into pieces? What could it mean to say that it's a piece of God? God can be dismembered, sort of cut up into pieces? Doesn't sound right. On the other hand, that one you can't avoid because it's definitely part of tradition. The other one maybe we can avoid. I have to explain how to avoid it. Then there's a slightly more subtle problem. There are certain descriptions of God which are part of the tradition. And the words that are used in these descriptions have an official definition. The Mishnah, the Talmud, gives a definition of these words. when you try to take the word with its definition and apply it to God, it gives very funny results. It seems like a very funny result. Let's take Kippur. Kippur is translated into English as mighty. The Mishnah says, Kippur, who is mighty, who is truly mighty? He who conquers his own spirit. He who conquers his own spirit. Now, the Mishnah there is talking about people. People have desires, they have impulses. They know intellectually often that fulfilling those desires or acting on those impulses is incorrect. The Mishnah says, he who can control his spirit, he's truly mighty. So the model I have is a model of human being. And that's common experience. But the very same word, gibor, is used for God. It's a word in Hebrew. For us, the Hebrew language is the language of emes, of ultimate reality. The same word is used. It can't be that it means something entirely different vis-a-vis God. On the other hand, who is mighty, he who conquers his own spirit? I start to think of God as conquering his own spirit. That picture doesn't sound right at all. So, making sense of terms like that as applied to God, also a considerable difficulty. We have three difficulties. There are more, but easily representative, and we can achieve some solution for these. I think we'll have what we need to apply to other things if we go up. Now, I said there were two assumptions that we're going to base the discussion on. Number one, everything we are doing tonight is in the tradition. We're not speculating, we're not theorizing, we're not intuiting, we're not being spiritually creative. This is not New Age flower waiting. God is not a subject about which speculation is appropriate. God is utterly different from anything in our world, and if he didn't tell us how we're supposed to think about him, we wouldn't have a clue. So everything I'm going to say is based on sources. I'm doing my best to try to understand those sources as any person should. Nothing's being made up here. Number two, I believe the tradition has this assumption, and I certainly operate with this assumption, that when you talk, it better make sense. This is an exercise in what can be said. What can be said about God? What can be said? What can be communicated? What can be understood? If in the discussion it's suggested that XYZ is the truth, and somebody says, look, listen, XYZ contradicts ABC, and the response is, oh, well, but maybe when you talk about God, it doesn't mean what it usually means. You know, these words can mean something entirely different. At that point, the game has been given up. It's all projects have been given up. If the means word means something entirely different, and you know what they mean, then you're not making sense. You're just using sound. I just all say blah, blah, blah. This is an exercise in trying to understand. There are limits to understanding, of course. We may fail in our attempt to understand, and we should honestly say, I don't get it. We don't understand it, we failed. Rather than saying, yeah, it's all right. It just doesn't mean what you think it means. What does it mean? I don't know, I can't tell you. But we've got it. We've done it. We've said what it is. That's just playing games. Either it makes sense or it doesn't. If it doesn't, honestly admit that it doesn't, and say that you haven't succeeded. That, I think, is the ground rules by which the game has to be played. Okay, now, I want to give you a central idea, which I think is the way to relate to all the problems. One central idea, I'll explain it to you, and then I will try to make it perhaps more familiar than otherwise by giving you analogies. It may sound like the idea is outlandish entirely. You may think of intellectual objections to the idea. I want to try to make the idea palatable, reasonable. And then I will stop for discussion of the idea, and then I'll show you how that idea solves the problems that we start. The idea is, this is what it says, again, in the philosophers and the Kabbalists, we don't talk about what God is, we talk about what God does. What God is out of bounds, beyond, transcendent, inconceivable, undescribable. We only talk about what he does. All the descriptions in the Tanakh, in the Midrash, in the Talmud, in the Siddur, all the descriptions of God are descriptions of what he does, not of what he is. What he is, we don't have a clue. All we have is descriptions of what he does. Now, often enough, people are uncomfortable with that very idea. How can you describe what a thing does if you have no idea what it is? If you're talking about what it does that automatically include an idea of what it is? To say you're describing what it does and read out what it is just not comprehensible. It's people don't think like that, the mind doesn't work like that, the world doesn't work like that. When you describe what a thing does, you're automatically including some conception of what it is. I want to show you by analogy that that's not correct. That we tolerate, we even have historical examples of things where we could describe what they do, at least to a certain extent, without any conception whatsoever of what they are, either where they had no conception or the conceptions they had were utterly unrealistic, utterly incorrect. It didn't prevent them from having an accurate, reasonable description of what they are. What they do. Let's take the stars. Stars shine. To the eye, they shine the same every night. They rise and they set after a certain pattern. They're going on that way for thousands of years. And people can describe it. They can say, this star's here, that star's there. And some of the stars wander. We call them planets. But in ancient times, they were wandering stars. They move from one place to another. And they could tell you roughly, May it'll be there, and July it'll be there. What makes them shine? They're shining, getting off light. What makes them shine? In ancient times, they didn't have a clue. They had some really weird theories, the best of which that I know is that the night sky is a piece of black velvet, and behind the black velvet is a sea of everlasting light, infinite light, and there are little holes in the velvet. And the stars are the holes in the velvet letting through the light. That was one thought. A thought. I mean, there was absolutely no reason to think it was true. There was absolutely no evidence for it. Nobody ever reached out and felt the velvet. You know, it was just a thought, right? Nuclear fusion was beyond their whole conceptual scheme. So, they could see what they were doing. They were giving light. Some twinkle, some don't twinkle. But what it is that's giving the light, how it's giving the light, why it's giving the light, they didn't have a clue. Another example. Ask someone 200 years ago, what is the difference between marble and wood? So I'll tell you, marble is a stone. You dig it out of quarries in the earth. It's brittle, it's very hard, it's cold to the touch. Wood grows in trees, it's buoyant, floats on water, it's flammable, it'll burn. You can saw it, you can bang nails into it, you can't do any of that with marble. And I ask him, why are they that way? What makes the marble different from the wood? What explains why the marble is hard, the wood is soft, the marble feels cold, the wood feels warm? What makes it that way? The true answer is molecules and atoms. Didn't have a clue 200 years ago about molecules, not a clue. What could he say? I don't know, just, you know, our world has wood in it, our world has marble in it, and we know what they do. I know if you throw a marble chip into the water, it'll sink. I know if you throw a wood chip into the water, it'll float. I know a lot about what they do. He didn't have a clue as to what they are. Not a clue. Let's take sound. This is a good example that I'm drawing from Thomas Nagel. Sound. 400 years ago. What is sound? We know a lot about what sound does. We know how to make sounds. Bang on a snare drum. You know? Bang two pots together. We know that sound causes you to experience certain things. Sometimes sounds can make things shake. We know that sounds can be contained. If you're in a very solid room that's airtight, make a sound. Outside, you'll hear nothing or next to nothing. We know that sounds can be reflected from walls, echoes. What is the sound? It's something there, but what is it? You stand there, he makes a sound, and he hears it over there, and I'm standing in the middle. I don't feel anything, I don't see anything, I don't taste anything, I don't smell anything, I don't feel any heat. No one had a clue that sound is wave motion of air particles, and even that they wouldn't have understood, because I don't think in nature there are any longitudinal waves. The waves you have in nature are transverse waves. In other words, when the water waves, the wave moves this way, but it waves this way, up and down, at right angles to its directional motion. In air, the wave moves this way, and the wave motion is successive alternations in the direction of motion. I don't think you have waves like that in the, you know, when you have a wave and a string, the wave moves left to right, and it waves up and down. They didn't have a clue what sound was. They just knew that sound does various things, and we can make sounds in various ways. But what it is, they have a clue. Light. They knew a lot about what light does. Mirrors, art. The whole industry of art is based on knowing what kinds of interactions there are between light and various pigments and brush strokes and canvas and all the rest. What is light? Descartes said it was a particle. Young's proof that it's a wave. No one could figure out how it could be both a particle and a wave. Today, it's called a wavicle, which is a wave just of the announcement we don't understand. Richard Feynman said, don't try to understand it. No one has ever survived that. We know what it does. We know what it is. Not really. So being in a position where you know what something does, but you don't know what it is, I think it's very common in the history of thought. It's even present at the present time. So I don't think anyone should object. You're telling me you could describe what God does, but not what he is. That's a contradiction. How can you describe what he does without knowing what he is? Answer, we do that all the time. It's very common. It shouldn't be regarded as an objection. There's a little twist here, though. It's not just we don't know what God is. It's that we can't know what God is. We can't know what God is. That's the position. That's what we've received in our tradition. We can't know what God is. Maybe that is a problem. The stars, we figured out. It's nuclear fusion. Light, sort of figured out. Sound, we definitely figured out. Molecules for marble and for wood, we definitely figured out. You're telling me now that you can describe what God does, but God is something which is impossible to figure out? Maybe that's a problem? But here's why I don't think there's a problem. Because, first of all, everybody knows there are limits to what human beings can understand. Your brain is finite, and it can only hold a certain amount of information. You cannot, as far as I know, multiply 2 100-digit numbers in your head. You just don't have enough systematic storage space. And if you can do it for 100, you can't do it for 1,000, or 10,000, or a million. You can multiply 2 million-digit numbers in your head because you haven't got enough organized storage space. There are philosophical problems which some philosophers have taken the position are beyond the human mind's ability to understand. The problem of consciousness, Colin McGinn writes, is probably beyond our ability to understand. And we all know we're conscious. We all experience our consciousness, but he has good evidence to think that we're ever going to understand it. So the fact that the tradition tells us we describe what he does, but not what he is, and we don't understand what he is, and we can't understand what he is, I don't think that's a problem either. There's nothing problematic in having a position where you say the way a thing appears, the way it interacts, the way it manifests to us, itself to us, the way we observe it, we can describe what the thing is behind the manifesting, behind the interaction, behind the observing, we can't describe. I don't think that's inherently a problem. Let's stop here and see if we're all on the same page.
When you spoke about you're in between problem two and problem three, you were saying problem two is how God relates to the world. Problem three is certain terms that are difficult when applied to man and then applied to God. You mentioned the soul. Which category did that fit into? And the soul has the peace of God on high.
That's one of the concrete descriptions of well, I put it into how it relates to the world.
Okay.
Problem two.
Okay.
Because I'm sort of giving it away. You're right to ask. I think of the soul as part of the world. That sort of begs the question. You're right. Putting it there sort of gives away the position in the end, instead of making it as a pure problem. It's a nice observation. Okay, yeah.
And in the evidence of the soul theorem, you discussed the idea of correlation does not equal identity.
Right.
That would then apply to what we're explaining right now as far as shooting. That correlation does not equal identity. You mean there's a correlation? Can you apply it to what's saying right now?
I don't think so. Okay, now, that means that all of the descriptions that we have in the tradition of God have to be understood as descriptions of what he does. Let's see how it goes. Let's try some candidates and see how we can make that understanding work. Sometimes it's not too difficult. God is just. Justice shows itself in action. Very directly. Justice means that you get what you deserve. What you earn, what's right for you, what's appropriate for you. God is just will mean that, at least eventually, we'll be able to see that my actions and what I receive are appropriate to one another. God is merciful. Mercy tempers justice. Justice may demand a negative response to a crime. Mercy says, let's give him another chance. Let's give him time to develop. Let's give him an opportunity to make restitution. It doesn't have to be immediate. Mercy may say, let's dish out half of the negative response now and see how he responds to it. Maybe the other half isn't necessary. Mercy will say that the negative response should be pegged to what contribution it will make to his future development, not just retribution for the mistake he's made in the past. Mercy tempers justice, and that means that God's actions will be mixed in a certain sense. There's justice, but there's also mercy. Loving kindness. Loving kindness means giving without any desert at all. To show God I love you, show kindness to you, I have to give you something that you have not earned. Something that you don't deserve. Something that's not yours by right. If you've earned it, if it's yours by right, I give it to you. I don't show that I love you. I just show that I'm not willing to cheat you. I show that I'm fair. I don't show that I love you. Love has to be shown by giving something that you haven't earned and have no right to and have no, you don't deserve. That should be something good. That means the picture's going to be even more mixed. When God does something, especially something good, who knows but what? It's an expression of love. Or maybe it's an expression of mercy, in spite of the fact that the person deserves less, or deserves something negative. But these are all principles that describe God. God loves, God is just, God is merciful, and these are fairly easy to translate into action. Then there are others which are a little harder. God is all-powerful. All-powerful doesn't sound like he's doing anything at all. All-powerful sounds like what he can. You know? How thick are his muscles? How much gas does he have in his car? How big is his electric power pack? I mean, how much power does he have? All-powerful. But you can translate that into what he does even so. What it means is there's no limit on the range of his actions. There's no limit. When he does, anything can happen. So I'm not now describing what he is or his energy surplus. I'm talking about what he does. And I'm simply saying, when you start describing what he does, you should know that what happens doesn't exhaust the limit of what could happen. Anything that's logically consistent in any way could happen because his actions have no limitation as to what they could be. So again, it's a quality of his actions. Even so seemingly internal description, a description of himself as omniscience, he knows everything. That doesn't sound like action at all. That's what he knows. As everyone is aware, things you know don't have to lead to action. You know lots and lots of things in which you never act at all. If I say it's all-knowing, how can I translate it into a statement about action? I want you to know that Rachel, the Tzata, whom I quote over and over and over again, in one of the essays on mystical basics, at the first page he says all the descriptions of God are descriptions of his actions, and he gives a whole list, and one of them is his knowledge. That's one of the items which is a description of his action. Though the Tzata doesn't spell out how that is, but he lists the item on the same page twice. I believe the right way to do it is this. His actions are all related to one another. Related to one another appropriately in terms of all their characteristics. It's again a quality of the actions, but it's a global quality. If you look how they're all set up, which follows which happens simultaneously, which happened to one person, which happened to 17 people, ultimately, you see that everything is adjusted appropriately. They all relate to one another in a way that reflects their true character appropriately. Now, in doing this, I gave you five examples already. Justice, mercy, love, all-powerful, and all-knowing. In doing this, I'm using a formula. It's a formula that I learned from philosophy of science, a certain particular position in philosophy of science. And the formula works like this. If you want to know what X means, here's what you do. Two steps. Number one, ask yourself. Suppose X were real. Don't be naive. I'm not thinking any deep thoughts, I'm not using any deep philosophy. Suppose X were real. Ask yourself, if X were real, what would it do? That's not too difficult. It's allowed to imagine that X is real. It really is X. And then what it would do? That's step one. Step two, subtract X. Just subtract X. And what you're left with is all the things that get done. So, intellectually, imaginatively, it's a two-stage process. The first step is based on a fantasy, suppose it were true, and then just subtract it and say, this is what it does. So you say, what is justice? Suppose God were really just. Pretend I could understand that. Pretend I wasn't doing philosophy right now. If I said God was just, what would I expect God to do being just? Now I make a list. If he's really just, then when people get things, they'll eventually get what they deserve, what they get to be appropriate to their actions, be able to see how he earned this, he earned that. That's what he would do if he were just. He would make sure that what you get is what you deserve. That's step one. Step two, just subtract justice. Subtract his really being just. Erase that from the picture. What you're left with is people getting what they deserve. So you start pretending it's real and calculate what the consequences are for action, and then you just erase it because it isn't really real and you're left with the consequences. That's a kind of method for translating any particular description of what he is into a description of what he does. And then, when we read throughout our literature descriptions, which linguistically are descriptions of what he is, we have to understand that our literature means, I'm telling it to you as if he was that. I'm speaking that way because it's a simple, easy, convenient way to speak. But of course, I don't literally mean that. What I literally mean is, the things that happen in the world have this character as if he were that. But I'm not really asserting that he is that. Are we together? Okay. Now, we have to push a step deeper. We're talking about describing God's actions. We have to think a little bit about what an action is. Because in truth, when you look into our descriptions, when you look into our literature, the descriptions do go beyond what you and I would call actions. Things happen. So I appreciate why it's not a contradiction, the reason why it's not a conflict, but to appreciate what an action really is. People move around. Their bodies move around. You cannot tell me what a person's action is just by watching him moving around. Because an action is not a motion of the body. For example, I saw him handing a $100 bill to George. Was he giving a gift? Well, first of all, maybe he was paying for something that he bought. Or maybe George had a gun on him, if you didn't see, and he was just saving his life. Or maybe he was hypnotized, and he was really unconscious of what he was doing altogether. Maybe he was sleepwalking. Seeing the hand go in the pocket and pull out that other one and hand it over does not tell you what action is being performed. Here's another example. I lived through the Vietnam protests. College students sat in university buildings and in highways, stopped traffic, and they were taken off to jail. In the legislatures that had to deal with this civil disobedience, there was a suggestion that was debated that the students should be treated very roughly. Call out the National Guard and go in with rifles and bayonets, club them over the head, tie them up, and throw them into the vans, and toss them on the floor, you know, beat them up. The supporters of this rough policy broke down into two groups. One group was the arch-conservatives who said, break it! Break it! The other was the arch-radicals who said, beat him up, treat him roughly, and you'll stimulate a rebellion, a revolution that will overthrow the government. Now, the president of the council calls for a vote. How many are in favor of the rough policy? And the hands go up. Some are voting to save the state, and some are voting to overthrow the state. All the hands are going up. What action is the person performing? Unless you know something about the inner life of the person, you don't know what the action is. A human being's action is not just the motion of his body. You read a biography, or an autobiography. The fascination of a biography, or a good novel, or a good piece of theater, is experiencing the inner life of the person, which expresses itself in his actions. So you'll understand what the action means. So you'll understand what action the bodily motion is performing. There's a musical, I think it's called The Sound of Music. This goes back to ancient times, about 60 years ago. I remember one thing. There's a man who is a father and he's one child, and he deserts the family. There's all sorts of problems, personality problems, criminal, terrible things. Years later, he comes back. He wants to see his family. But he's embarrassed to be seen by them. He disguises himself. And he had a daughter who was now, I don't know how old she was, 10 years old or something. He comes, look, and she's in the street, he's in the street. I don't remember exactly how it happens, but they talk, whatever it is, and he gives her a slap. And he runs away. And her mother sees her from the house, running out. What happened? Why did he slap you? And she says, slap me? It felt like a caress. Now, that means that although there was a contact of skin on skin, an impact of skin on skin, the way in which it was done presented itself to her in an entirely different fashion. She saw something in him with the slap that made it feel like a caress. That's because it isn't just the motion of an object coming into contact with another object. Had a slab of wood been blowing in the wind and hit her in the face, she would never have felt that as a caress. But it wasn't a slab of wood blowing in the wind. It was a human interaction. What is it that makes what a human being does an action rather than just a motion of the body? Now, I suppose different people could do this differently. I have my way of doing it, and I think this fits into what we find in the tradition. My word for the difference is will. An action is the outer expression of a will to do. And if it isn't the expression of a will, it's not an action at all. Sleepwalking, hypnosis, tripping over something and smashing into it, it's not an action of breaking something. Not an action of breaking something, even though the person's body does smash it, it's not an action of breaking something. Because didn't the body have will to break something? Will is what makes the bodily motion into an action. What is will? Well, at least I can say this. I think will has three components. How the components are put together, what the exact meaning is, but that nobody knows. It's too hard to follow. What we can say is this. Will has three components. The most essential element in will is its purpose. What is supposed to be achieved by what happens? Second element is a choice of means to achieve the purpose. And the third element is a conception of the world which makes the means appropriate to the purpose. Choosing the means is because I say, I want to achieve that, and I live in a world that looks like this, I have these resources, and I have these resources, so this is the means that I choose to achieve that purpose. Will has these three elements. I mean, this is the key description of a will. Purpose, means, and the conception of the world. This is not too far from what Flach was talking about, the belief, desire, model of action, but I don't think belief is comprehensive enough. I don't think desire is much too narrow, but it's definitely related. It's definitely related. What I'm saying now is not too controversial. I'm not straying into unknown territory to say this, but I think my terminology is a little deeper, a little more comprehensive, and more accurate. Now, when we talk about describing God's actions, that includes will. It has to include will. Because if you're just going to talk about happenings aren't actions. Happenings aren't actions. Because it was a storm. Why did a storm happen? God did it. That's not yet describing it as an action. That's like saying, the vase is broken. What happened? Well, George's body crushed it. That may be true. It still doesn't tell me that it was an action. Maybe the wind blew him over and he fell out and they crushed him. To be an action, there has to be a will behind it. So to say I'm going to describe God's actions means I have to be able to describe his will. And indeed, that is what we do. The literature talks directly about God's purposes, which is the one element of the will. The deeper literature talks about what means are chosen for the purposes. And the even deeper literature talks about how the world is structured in such a way that these means are relevant to those purposes. All of that is included in the project of describing God's actions.
What can be Hashem's will in himself? Hashem himself.
The difference is that himself can't be described at all. That's where we started. We started by saying we cannot describe what he is, we only describe what he does. Will is part of the description of action. What he is the being that has the will. Wills don't float separate. They don't just float to the air. If you mean anything by will, it means that it's had by some being that has it. But what is that being? What is it like? We have the clue. It's just like someone 20 years ago would say, I know that the marble and the wood are different. And I know they're different on the basis of their ultimate constitution. But what they're ultimately constituted by, I haven't a clue. If you would tell them they're ultimately constituted by electricity, he would laugh you out of the room. And if you tell them they're ultimately constituted by 99% empty space, he would laugh you out of the room. He would not know what you are talking about, even though that's the literal truth. But he'd have a clue. So he said, of course, I know the table's made of something. Of course, it's made of something. I don't know what it is. And whatever that something is, that's what makes it do what it does. So I haven't a clue how.
Are you supposed to say that Hashem has will and what?
Well, there are Jewish sources that say that God has an ear. So all these sources have to be understood carefully. In fact, what I've already told you is there in the scripture. If you think God is just, I'm telling you, the way to understand God is just is just things happen in the world. So the fact that it says, don't be hypnotized by what it says. Don't take what it says too naively. We're in the business of reinterpretation. In the business of explaining what things mean. and answer the problems I started with, although you can probably see where I'm going to answer those problems, but I'm just trying to get the main idea clear. So we do talk about God's purposes, we do talk about God's the means for the purposes, we do talk about the way reality is organized so it makes it relevant, so all the elements of the will we can talk about. We talk about God's action as events that manifest his will with those elements of will that we can describe because the tradition displays them to us. Okay? Really? Now, that's more or less the answer to the first problem. What you can't describe him, but on the other hand, we talk about it. The answer is we don't talk about what he is, we talk about what he does. Why don't we talk about what he is? Why don't we? I'm skipping a step of how do you know we can't. I've spoken to some of you about the difference between proof and explanation. I'm jumping right to the explanation. Because I started with the premise that we can't. The explanation of why we can't is this. Maimonides actually has this in the guide. Words, we use words to describe the world. Sometimes the words are used competently to describe. Maybe wrongly, maybe rightly, but they're competent. And sometimes, if you break certain rules, the words are incompetent. For example, if I say the table is brown, that's correct. Certainly competent. If I say the table is purple, it's competent to say it, it's just wrong. Just made a mistake. If I say the number 6 is brown, that's not just a mistake, that's incompetent. Anybody who speaks the language knows that numbers don't have colors. They're not the kind of being that could have colors. Someone said, number 6 is brown, I think we'd want to worry about his sound. Someone says the table's purple, we'd wonder about his color vision. Maybe he's got a problem with optic nerve. That's a more understandable mistake to make. Anybody who understands what 6 is and what brown is knows they can't go together. They just can't go together. You don't have to have any special intelligence. You don't have to be able to be knowledgeable about the world. You don't have to have been to China. You know what numbers are. You know what colors are. You know numbers and colors don't mix. A minor example is this. Imagine a stone wall. Of course, a stone wall is not hairy. Stones don't grow hairs. But a stone wall is not bald either. Because hairy and bald are terms that are used for things that grow hair. Things that grow hair, to have the hair, are hairy. If a thing that grows hair doesn't have hair because it lost all of it, then it's bald. Things that don't grow hair are not hairy and they're not bald. Hairy and bald don't apply to them. It's not what you use to talk about stones. This is what an infamous philosopher of the mid-20th century, Gilbert Ryle, called the category of mistake. He thought he was inventing the idea. That's because he didn't read my eyes. I should read my eyes. Okay. So now, the official explanation is what Maimonides uses it for, the guide, is that when you take any of our language and try to apply it to God, you're just as bad off as saying that the number 6 is brown or that the wall is bald. None of our language applies to God. It's all a mistake. A misfire. It doesn't connect. A little bit more detail. All of our language is designed to apply to particular kinds of things. Things in our world. Things in our environment. Colors apply to physical objects. Mathematical terms like odd and even, prime and composite, whole, fraction, they apply to numbers. The table is not a prime, the table is not composite, the table is not odd, the table is not even. It's the wrong vocabulary. We have categories. We have physical objects. We have numbers. We have concepts. We have properties. We have sets, functions. We have all different kinds of categories of things. Each category has the words that we use to talk about the things in that category. God isn't in any of the categories. God is not a physical object. God is not a number. God is not a concept. God is not a property. God isn't any of those things. So our language just doesn't apply. That's one way to explain why we're incompetent to think about God, to talk about God, because a language is designed to describe elements of the creation, not the creator.
Yeah.
Is it incompetent to say that God is indescribable or infinite or the creator?
Creator describes what he does. It's a description of his action. So we're back to where we started. If you speak negatively, what you're essentially doing is denying a description of him. If you say he's incomparable, it means I can't compare him to anything. That speaks about what I can't do, not what I can do. That's perfectly right. To deny our ability to talk about him is fine. You can deny it in general, you can deny it in particular, go up and down the line. It's perfectly right.
So I think that the table is not incomparable.
Well, it's a funny thing to say. It's as if to say, it could have been, and I'm taking it seriously as a possibility, and I'm giving you a piece of information, but it's not. That's not true. It couldn't have been, it's not a possibility, it's not something that I need your information to tell me that it's not. It's a funny use of the language.
So it's a funny thing to say that God is infinite?
Well, if infinite means not finite, that's fine. So if infinite means what mathematicians mean by infinite, then it's wrong. If he isn't infinite in mathematical sense, then definitely not.
Is it incompetent to say that he's not indescribable? Just like it's incompetent to say that table is not finite.
In a way, yes, in a way it is, but considering the amount of confusion there is about God, you know, the person might be confused to the point where he wasn't aware of these things. Because nowhere is the number six is brown used at all. On the other hand, describing God, there are lots and lots and lots of descriptions of God. So it can sound like you can describe God. What I said in the first half, which you weren't here for, where we just understood that we're only describing his actions, that's a brand new idea to many people. So it may be useful to correct this misconception that God could be described. It may be useful to do that. But in strict linguistic terms, of course, it would be just as incompetent. It's just not incompetent interpersonally because people have mistaken ideas about this. Okay, so now for the... Now for the final general step. We say that God is will. This is the most daring step. This now comes from the Kabbalah. I don't know of any reference to this in philosophy directly, but if you look at the statements in the Talmud, you have it. You have all the sound that you're without the mechanics behind, and the Kabbalah does the mechanics behind. Really, instead of talking about God as will, we should talk about God as wills in the plural. There are many divine wills. Let's see why. We spoke of God in terms of justice, mercy, and loving kindness. So we said, those aren't real attributes, those are just actions that take place. But we said, actions are the expression of will. And will has to have a purpose. So when I spoke of God as having the quality of loving kindness and transferred that into a description of actions, the purpose of those actions will be loving kindness. That people should be benefited and benefited in a way that is not earned. As I said, the essence, the most essential element in any will is the purpose that the will embodies. Actions of loving kindness embody the purpose of loving kindness. Actions of justice embody the purpose of justice. If there are two different purposes, then there are two different wills. If the purpose is the essence of the will, and you have a will whose purpose is loving kindness, and another will whose purpose is justice, then essentially, the way we think of will, it's two different wills. Another will is mercy. You're going to have a multitude of wills. You're going to have a multitude of wills. Let me just stop to introduce a footnote, which, if we have time, I'll elaborate on. Notice that this makes the picture very human-like. Because human beings also have many different purposes. And they have wills to accomplish those purposes. And this makes the picture of God very human-like in that respect. He has many different purposes, and he has wills to accomplish those purposes. And it turns out the different divine names refer to different wills. And it turns out that those references are context-dependent. The same name in different contexts might refer to different levels of will. Okay, I introduced the word level, which should hint to you that maybe there's a hierarchy here, not just a big, not just a set. And this is absolutely essential from the Kabbalistic point of view, that there are different wills on different levels with different purposes, and they can work singly, and they can work in cooperation with one another. Now, for 100 extra points. And they can... Yes, they can conflict with one another. Those wills can conflict with one another. Now you can get to the answer of one of the questions that I asked. We said mighty is defined by the rabbis as he masters his spirit, which pictures the human being with an inner conflict. That's very common. We undergo that all the time. Every one of us knows what it means to have an inner conflict. And to win the conflict with your better side and feel the satisfaction, yes, I overruled my impulses and my base desires, and I did what I know to be right. The minute you describe God as a multitude of wills, having a multitude of wills, something like that, you set up the possibility of conflict between those wills, and you set up the idea of the resolution of the conflict as one will mastering the other will, and you have the possibility of transferring the term Gibor, mighty, literally to God with exactly the same definition. I think this is an extremely striking result. It's a striking result that this can be done. Let's take mighty. God is mighty. God is strong. What is strength? Power. Power is the ability to overcome resistance. That's what it is by definition. Say God is powerful, not in this sense of keyboard, but chazak, strong. Say that he's strong means he can overcome resistance. The immediate question arises. He can overcome resistance? What? Move a mountain? Terrific. He's the creator. He can move a mountain? He can drain the sea? You know, what are you talking about? What kind of resistance is that? The only resistance that would be worthwhile to describe, to justify the term strong, would have to be internal resistance. It would have to be him against himself. How can it be against himself? Well, if there's a group of wills, a hierarchy of wills, and they can contradict one another, then strength can apply to the will that regularly takes precedence over the other will. So strength becomes a literally applied term. The same meaning that strength has for human beings. They can overcome resistance. When it's used for God, it means exactly the same thing. Only, in this case, the only resistance that's worthwhile is thinking about is internal. No external resistance counts more than zero for him. But if there is internal resistance, one will have the resistance of another will, and it can be described as strong. It overcomes that will. Same thing happens with holy, although holy is more complicated. I can't go into it tonight. But this I got only because my son showed it to me, and there's a book which takes the philosophy out of Luzzano's letters. He wrote many letters, and we have a number of them, and some of them he explained philosophical ideas, and there's a collection of the philosophy that's found in his letters. And my son showed me a discussion there of holy, which solved this problem in exactly the same way. Exactly the same way. The minute you think of God as a hierarchy of wills, then these descriptions become quite easy to explain. It's called, I think it's called Gimzei Rachal, but it's only in Hebrew, it's not in English. It's. Anyway, now, the last thing I asked, or it was the second there, was how does God relate to the world? When you say he fills the world and there is nothing but him, Kabbalah, some have read that he had to contract to leave over an empty space to which things exist, and so on and so on. And then the soul, which is a piece of God on high. Here's the truth about these matters. Our conception of God is will. That is to say, what we can describe, what we can understand. Nothing more than that can we understand. All our terminology of God is describing will and the expression of will in events.
So when we give him attributes such as like all-knowing, all-powerful, it's just concepts pertaining to the description of his will.
That's right. Will and the actions that come out of the will. God is described as will. No will is a table, and no table is a will. They're the wrong kind of things. They're in two entirely different categories. So to say that God is in the table is absolutely incorrect. It's just as incorrect as saying the number six is in the table. Number six couldn't be in the table because number six isn't a physical thing at all. It has no location. God's will has no location either in anywhere. It doesn't weigh any amount, doesn't have a size, doesn't have a color. Wills aren't like that. It's the wrong category of thing. And here's what I indicated at the beginning, where some people say, oh, of course you can't understand it. Of course, it's a paradox, but it's true anyway. And that's where I get off the ship. Excuse me. The whole name of the project is to try to understand, to say what can be said. If you say words, and when you're attacked that the words don't mean anything, you say, of course it don't mean anything, but that's how we do it. We're not going to give it up the game. That wasn't the project. The project was to try to speak and understand. If you can't understand, then just say you can't understand. Rock a shot. But don't pretend that you've explained something by using words that can't be understood. God's will is not a table, a table is not a will. When it is said that God is everywhere, what it means is everything is supported by God's will. God's will is effective everywhere. God's will is effective everywhere. Not that He is there, but His will, because that's all of Him that I have, is effective everywhere. Laisus apanui mine, like the Zohar says, there's no place empty of Him, means there's no place where His will does not reach. Without His will, if a thing were disconnected from His will, it couldn't exist. Therefore, every place that is a place where His will reaches, because otherwise it wouldn't be. You don't slice God into slices. The soul is a created thing. In that respect, it's no different in principle from a table. It's a created thing. No soul is God, no God is soul. So what does it mean when it says, Tzchelek Elokani Ma? Ooh, I just thought of a nice analogy. What do we mean when we say, John is a chip off the old block? We can say that, don't we? We don't mean that we took a slice of his father Peter and built him into John. What we mean is that John's like Peter. You can see Peter and John. You can see his attributes, you can see his character, you can see his predilections. You mean he's similar to him. And we use that phrase, chip off the old block. And don't tell me he's a DNA. Give me a break. People say that before they drift of DNA. This is what it means. It means that the item in the universe, the item in the creation, that most represents God, plays God's role vis-a-vis, so to speak, is the soul. If you're looking for God's representative, it's the soul. The human being is a microcosm of the whole creation. The soul is to the body, as God is to the whole creation. That's the analogy that's given. But that's all. No more than that. Nothing more literal than that. And when it is said, if you haven't read this, I don't remember reading it. It's just unintelligible if you haven't heard the background, but if you've heard the idea that God constricted himself to leave space, and the world was created in that space, ladies and gentlemen, the way you hear those words is utterly incorrect. First of all, I'll tell you something which very few people know, because they read that one sentence and then they go off and drink a beer. But if you study literature carefully, you'll find out that officially, when God constricts himself and leaves behind the space is full, not empty. It isn't empty space. It's empty of the infinite light. But it's not empty. There's a different kind of light. It's called a Rashimu. So, there's a recording here, that's what I said. So, the idea of leaving empty space as room for tables, it has nothing to do with room for tables. Furthermore, a little deeper, if you imagine God emptying out a space, then beforehand, that space was filled. That doesn't mean there isn't a space. It just means it's filled. Space in the sense of place, location, size. Imagine somebody goes to the business of making marshmallows, and he fills up the whole universe with marshmallows. That means there's no more space. It means there's no more empty space. But there's still position, north, south, east, west, bigger, smaller, it has size. If you imagine God removing himself and leaving behind empty space, then we have to imagine that before he removed himself, there was filled space, place, size, direction. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. None of these terms apply to God. Even infinite size isn't right. Size isn't the right term for him. The universe could be infinitely big too. So, what it really means is, and I'll come back to the footnote that I gave you. This is only problematic. What it really means is this. When he created the universe, he decided to relate to human beings in a way that they could understand. I'm telling you now what's out to work with. He decided to relate to human beings in a way they could understand. And therefore, he interacts with us in an infinitely reduced manner. He interacts with us with a pattern, with a picture, with a structure that we can understand. If he interacted with us out of his infinity, we would understand it. It's just things would happen randomly. We wouldn't have any clue what's going on. Now, I said to you 17 and a half minutes ago, that's my joke, right? That when you have a collection of wills, each with its own purpose, and they can work together, work singly, they can even conflict with one another, I say that's a pretty familiar picture because that's the way we are. Human beings have different purposes, and they interact with one another. Sometimes you're on some severally, or individually, or together. They can contradict, you have to resolve conflicts. God decided, so to speak, to present himself to us that way, so that we could understand. He chose a deliberately anthropomorphic presentation so that we as anthropomorphs can be able to understand it. That's not because of what he is. This multiplicity of wills is only an appearance that he created. Well, I shouldn't say appearance, that's cancel that. It's only a mode of interaction that he chose so that we'll be able to understand where the interactions come from, what their structure is, where they're going. We'll be able to interpret them. But that required an infinite holding back of the rest of his being. That's symptom. That's contraction. The contraction means holding back his infinity and not putting it into play, not using it in interacting with us, so that what's left, which is a finite residue, we'll be able to understand. When the Arizal and those who came after him speak about the infinity contracting and leaving a space, and in the space is the creation, that's what they're talking about. That's just a metaphor. It's not real space. You shouldn't ask whether there are Heisenberg particles in that space. It's the wrong question. So that kind of space. It means he's going to present himself to creatures on a level that they can understand and interact with, and the rest of himself back. It's just a metaphor. Space is not real space there. Okay, I hope that this helps. Loving kindness and justice.
In creating the world, I'm saying.
Yes. Especially. Yeah. Yeah. All of these.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about the moment
when
you're angry.
No, it's not a metaphor. I just said, I'll show you.